From Melman Consulting, this is 14th and G, the podcast at the intersection of business, politics, and culture. Coming to you from the heart of Washington, D.C.
Welcome to 14th and G. This is Dean Rosen.
Today we are going to dive deep into the current issue, which is roiling Washington, D.C., which is we're approaching nearly day 30 of the government shutdown. The Senate this week voted for the 13th time to reopen the government and try to pass the House passed clean continuing resolution. The vote outcome for the 13th vote was the same as the first 12, which is it did not pass, and we are still in shutdown. And we've got two experts today to help us dive super deep into that. In the second half of our hour, we're going to speak with Bill Hoagland, who is a veteran of budget and spending wars in Washington, currently the senior vice president at the Bipartisan Policy Center. But we're going to kick off today's show at 14th and G by speaking with Samantha Handler, a reporter at Punchbowl News who is following every single TikTok, every single day, every single hour, every single minute of the government shutdown. Samantha, welcome to 14th and G.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to be with you. So before we get into the shutdown, I want to make sure the audience knows a little bit about you and a little bit about Punchbowl. Tell us a little bit about your background. How long have you been at Punchbowl? I know you had some reporting experience before that at Bloomberg. Tell us a little bit about your story and what you are doing at Punchbowl News.
Right. So I've been reporting at Punchbowl for about a year now, but I've been on the Hill reporting for several years. I was a tax reporter at Bloomberg, and now at Punchbowl I cover policy more broadly, all things policy, specifically recently appropriations, which of course we'll get into more, and how that's playing into the shutdown. My first experience actually in Washington reporting was in the 2018-2019 government shutdown.
You're a veteran. Here we are again. Yeah, deja vu all over again, as we say.
Very different shutdown, though.
Yeah. And you're a graduate of Northwestern University. And they're, I think they're having kind of a mediocre year in the Big Ten this year. If you haven't looked at the standings,
hey, we beat Penn State, so that's all I'm down for.
That's true. We got some Penn Staters here at Melman Consulting, so we got to be really careful. But
sure.
But welcome Samantha. And it sounds like, as you said, you're following this day to day. You also have experience covering the first shutdown. I want to ask you a little bit about Punchbowl, but let me just ask you a few questions about the shutdown first. For you, how is the shutdown in 2025 the same or different than the last shutdown in 2018 that you covered?
I mean, the vibe on Capitol Hill is so much different, right? Because I'm in the Capitol right now, and it's quieter. The House is not in session, which is a big difference. This is a full government shutdown as opposed to the first shutdown I covered, which is my first experience on Capitol Hill, that was a partial government shutdown. And there really isn't a lot of conversations going on. There's not a lot of active negotiations. There's not a lot of bipartisan talks. So it's a lot different in a lot of those ways. But I think as the weeks go on, we'll see the pressure build, and maybe we'll see more of those conversations start happening.
You know, it's ironic. You sort of point out that the last time we had the government shutdown in 2018 was a partial government shutdown. Only part of the government was shut down. Now we've got the full government shutdown. But just shockingly, that doesn't seem to have added more pressure. In fact, the parties seem to be even more dug in or even farther apart maybe than when this thing began. As you said, there's no – from what I've picked up in my conversations, my team's conversations – here at Melman, it doesn't seem to be any real bipartisan substantive negotiation, whether it be over the spending issue or over the healthcare issue, the advanced enhanced tax credits, which is kind of at the heart of this for the Democrats. Is that what you're picking up too, that they're just, they're not talking at all, or are there some limited talks that you're hearing because you're recording and reporting here from the Capitol as we speak?
That's exactly what we're hearing as well. I mean, there is a bipartisan group that's been talking, but they've, specifically said they're talking, not negotiating, but even that seems to have died down recently. I think part of it is there's not a lot of pressure yet. This week was the first week, of course, that air traffic controllers missed a full paycheck. As of now, the troops are still being paid. You know, J.D. Vance, the vice president, came out this week and said, you know, they're going to find more money to keep troop pay going. So, you know, that relieves a lot of pressure points. But, you know, we'll see if the air traffic controllers, if that starts upping pressure on lawmakers who are, you know, senators are still flying back and forth from Washington to back to their states. So that's something that they will see in person. And we'll start, you know, Thanksgiving holidays coming up. So it's those kind of things that might spur some talks.
Yeah, and we'll get into this a little bit in our second part of the show with Bill Hoagland from the Bipartisan Policy Center. But that's really been my sense, too, that both sides seem pretty dug in. I believe that we're sort of at a point where maybe the Democrats or the Republicans don't think they're necessarily winning, but neither side feels like they're losing. And it's ironic because this is a full shutdown that those pressure points haven't been felt. But I know you wrote a story this week here. If you're listening here the week of October 27th about the air traffic controllers and the issues there. I know there was a letter yesterday that I thought was a new development, a new fact by the unions for the air traffic controllers urging a reopening, basically kind of the Republican position coming out of a union traditionally affiliated with the Democratic Party. So do you see the air traffic control issue as kind of the key here to unlock this whole thing? Are there other issues out there? We've heard about the SNAP program, the nutrition programs, and others. Tell us, you know, sort of what you think the new facts that might present itself, the new pressure points that might present themselves may push this and move it more toward a time of a reopening.
Right. So the air traffic controllers union, that was the second union we saw come out this week and say, hey, we need to open the government. We need to end the government shutdown. The federal workers union, the largest, one of the largest units in the country, came out and said it's time to end the shutdown. Senate Democrats did not seem really moved by that this week. Of course, they said it's really not a new position from these unions, that the unions are, of course, anti-government shutdowns because their employees are not getting paid.
Right.
But, of course, as this weekend comes and, you know, air traffic controllers don't show up to work because they're not getting paid and, you know, there are more flight cancellations. You know, in Dallas, there was a ground halt. LAX had a ground halt. You know, as this is going to get worse, not better, in terms of air travel. And then, as you mentioned, SNAP runs out in November, and the White House has said they will not keep funding SNAP through November, even though some senators say there are funds to do so, and there's a mechanism to do that.
And SNAP is the supplemental nutrition program that provides basically food assistance to millions of low and modest income Americans, right?
Yeah, so people really start to feel this. You know, LIHEAP, which is a funding source for, you know, low-income people who need to, you know, help heating their homes, that starts turning out in November. A lot of these pressure points, as we said, just get worse and, you know, hit harder once November 1st hits.
So let me ask you, that there's sort of two things, and then maybe one or the other, or maybe both. You've touched on both of them, but let me ask you your view on this. Number one, you know, is this a function of the fact, this prolonged shutdown, of the fact that the real people, sort of the outside the beltway, out where you and I live, aren't really feeling this yet, but they might start feeling it when things like low-income heating assistance, food and nutrition programs, airline travel gets delayed, gets snagged. Is that the primary issue, that it really hasn't broken through yet to people outside of the bubble of Washington, D.C., or the swamp of Washington, D.C., depending on your perspective? Or is it the fact that we're just at a time when we're in a much more partisan place now in the second Trump administration, where the parties are more and more divided, where there are fewer people sort of in the middle to make a deal? Is it one of those two things? Is it both of those things, or is it something else?
I think it's a combination, really. Like, you know, there hasn't been a lot of effects, you know, on – a lot of people haven't been affected by this government shutdown yet, but they will be, right? I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is, of course, that there's more partisanship now. There's less bipartisanship. you know, a lot, you know, normally in a government shutdown, we would see people like Lisa Murkowski, you know, acting as sort of a conduit or a liaison between Republicans and Democrats and working to find a deal. And that's not really happening. You know, Republican leadership is not leaning on its moderates to get a way out of this. They're digging into their current position. Same thing with Democrats. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see if the things change over the next few weeks. But that's all, you know, I think a reason why we did not see a quick resolution to the shutdown. I think if either of those things were less true, right, then maybe it would have been resolved within a week. But here we are, and we're staring down Thanksgiving without a resolution.
Well, let me ask you, Samantha, as a follow-up to that, because you're at Punch Bowl News, you are talking to you and your colleagues. You're not the only reporter there. You're fanned out across the Capitol. That's my understanding of what Punch Bowl means. It's a code word, I think, of maybe Secret Service code word for the actual Capitol, right? Is that what I understand?
It at least was. I believe they may have changed it now.
But, yeah, now that it's Punch Bowl News and everyone knows it. So, exactly. But you're in the Capitol. You're talking to folks on both sides of the aisle. Why aren't the you know, Lisa Murkowski, more of a moderate Republican senator from Alaska, you know, why aren't folks like that, Susan Collins, the lead appropriator in the Senate, a more moderate Republican from Maine, Mark Warner, a more moderate Democrat from nearby Virginia, has a lot of federal workers. Why aren't those folks talking to one another? Are there just fewer of them? Are the issues so difficult that they just can't bridge the difference? Is the leadership and the president sort of pulling them back from talking on both sides of the aisle? What's your view of just why they're only, you know, having, as you said, sort of discussions but not negotiations?
Right. I mean, I think it's that those people aren't, you know, as representative of the parties now. You know, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins want a deal on the ACA credits, which is what Democrats have been demanding too. Lisa Murkowski actually even said this over the summer when she voted for the GOP reconciliation package. She said, you know, if we're going to do this and make these kind of changes and cuts to health care, we need to think about renewing these expiring credits later this fall and winter, which is now where we are. Susan Collins has said she, you know, wants to deal on this, and she was involved in those talks. But, you know, a bill like that probably can't pass the House of Representatives, or I say probably can't. I know it won't be able to pass the House of Representatives right now. You know, House Republicans just wouldn't want to take up a bill like that. I mean, we saw Speaker Mike Johnson last week or a few weeks ago, you know, stand up in a press conference with the Freedom Caucus, a very, you know, conservative part of the party, and, you know, talking with them about the shutdown. So that's really where Republicans are. And then on the other side of it, Democrats got hammered by the progressives in March for avoiding a shutdown. And now, you know, Chuck Schumer and other Democrats have to show, you know, they are willing to fight. They are willing to fight for health care, for these priorities. And people like Mark Warner, you know, who you would think, oh, a Virginia Democrat, has a lot of federal workers in his state, cares about that. He says, yes, I do care about federal workers, of course, but, you know, they're already being fired by the Trump administration. The shutdown does not make anything worse for them. So, you know, both sides are just really dug in.
Yeah, and both sides sort of have a reason not to reopen. They're hunkered down. And it seems that way to me, too, as you've described it. The left side of the Republican Party and the right side of the Republican Party seem to be pretty united behind their leaders and behind the president. The left flank, the base of the Democratic Party, and a more moderate wing of the Democratic Party seems to be united behind Chuck Schumer and Leader Jeffries in the Senate and the House, respectively, and don't seem to be budging. Is it your sense here, because, again, when I talk to both sides there, they do seem the same as you reported, sort of dug in. The one thing I keep hearing maybe consistently and even more loudly from Republicans in the last few days, both from key figures in the White House as well as key leadership folks on Capitol Hill, is the talking point, the mantra, the belief is the same. We are not going to negotiate, period, full stop, until the Democrats reopen the government. Even you hear the same thing from the so-called moderates that we just talked about. And at the same time, the Democrats are saying, we are not going to reopen the government unless there's an agreement, not just a process, not just a vote, not just an agreement for a vote, unless there's actually a substantive agreement on the Affordable Care Act tax credits. First question for you, Samantha, is that how you see it too? And then second, given that the Democrats have kind of met this immovable object of the Republicans, do you think they made the right decision or do you think they made a mistake by staking the shutdown on this healthcare issue?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's a great breakdown of how the situation currently stands. I would even go farther on the Democratic side and say that they have said they need a commitment in writing that, you know, something on the ACA credits.
They need a blood oath.
Yeah, something, yeah. Something more than a commitment to a vote, to take a vote. They want something to pass, which, of course, I, you know, think is unlikely to happen unless, you know, Trump is the big question mark here. You know, if President Trump comes out and says, I want a deal on ACA credits, I think Republicans would fall in line, and that would be the key here. And that's, of course, also what Democrats and some Republicans now have been saying. The president really needs to get involved in negotiations for this, for any movement to happen. They need leadership there. You know, I don't know if it was right or wrong for Democrats to stake the debate on this. I think the question for Democrats is really, you know, do they ultimately need to get a policy win out of this, or are they okay with a political win?
Do you think that the Democrats think that if they don't get a policy win, in other words, some extension of the Affordable Care Act credits, even for a year or two, do you think they'll feel like they've won politically if, let's say, the shutdown ends next week? Or do you think they really feel like they've got to have this policy?
I don't know if they know that at this point. I think it's unclear. I think plenty of Democrats really want a policy win here and are really pushing for that and want that. I don't know if that's possible to get. Like I said, I don't think that could pass the House of Representatives at this point. But, you know, Democrats have, you know, historically won on the healthcare message. You know, they, you know, I think they see that as a winning message going into the 2026 midterms of saying Republicans, you know, cut healthcare in their reconciliation package, and then they, you know, made things worse with premiums going up, and they did nothing on the ACA credits. I think plenty of Democrats see that as a winning message going into 2026. I think some Republicans are worried about that too.
Yeah, and that's the flip side of the coin. Do you, in your reporting and your conversations, do you think Republicans, again, they don't seem to be getting more worried about it, but do you think that political message is seeping through to more than just a handful of vulnerable House and Senate members, possibly Republicans in the next election? Is it breaking through at all? Do the Republicans feel like they're winning this?
Yeah, I think Republicans feel like they're winning the shutdown in a sense, right? I mean, I think they would have changed their position at this point if they felt otherwise. But there's plenty that do think that they need to change things up on the healthcare messaging. Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, said that they maybe Republicans need to do something, make some sort of deal on the ACA credits. And obviously, as we talked about, plenty of moderates think that as well. But the shutdown, of course, is a different story. And, you know, Republicans have sort of taken the old Democratic message and said Democrats are holding the government hostage and, you know, it's not the time to have this healthcare conversation. Let's reopen the government and then have that conversation.
Yeah, and it was interesting to me. I don't know I think this was actually a punchbowl interview with James Blair, who is the deputy chief of staff for the White House, sort of one of the political folks in the Trump White House last week, and he had very strong comments to say, kind of pushing back on the enhanced affordable tax credits, which to me was interesting because if he's got his political finger on the pulse, it seemed like his read was that Republicans don't need to negotiate on this, at least for now. I don't know if that's how you read it or maybe you read it differently.
Yes, and I think that's been the posture of House Republicans, right? This is a December conversation. And even a lot of Republicans are against these credits, say it was a COVID-era subsidy, which is true, that, you know, a lot of Republicans say that this is just going to help insurance companies, that it actually doesn't do anything to lower premiums. So, I mean, I think this is an ongoing conversation. It's not an easy conversation for Republicans, and they're saying let's reopen the government and then have that difficult negotiation that will take longer than a few days.
Well, the pain has not been felt by either the Democrats or the Republicans yet, as you said, sort of sufficiently. And you mentioned all of these external factors earlier. We'll see. We'll see when that happens. We did as a brief little commercial on our last 14th and G podcast. We dove really deeply into the issue itself of the ACA. We talked to Larry Lebitt, who heads up the policy shop at KFF, one of the kind of premier think tanks, research organizations in healthcare. And then we had sort of a little bit of a debate with my Democratic colleague Lauren Aronson, my Republican colleague Ali Mlinar, about sort of both sides, and got really deep into the credits themselves. And I think, to me, Samantha, one of the things that I learned from that podcast, and if you haven't heard it and you're interested, go back to click on your favorite podcast app or look at the Melman Consulting website, and you can listen to that as well. But one thing I learned from that too is that these are not easy issues. You know, in the past, sometimes we've had shutdowns over policy, but more often than not, they've bent over spending issues. So, you know, you can divide and come to a middle ground on a dollar amount, or sometimes on some of the policy riders that go along on these appropriations bills. But when you have a really complicated issue like repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, which was in part what the last one of the last shutdowns was about, or extending the enhanced tax credits, it's not only the politics of it, but it's also the substance of it, I think, that becomes challenging. Do you agree with that?
I do, and I think that's an interesting point. You know, it's a point we were hearing appropriators make before this started in September. You know, a lot of appropriators, the Four Corners, were coming out and saying, we're not going to discuss the ACA credits at this point. That's not an appropriations conversation. So, you know, and obviously Democrats have now said, now it is, you know, we want this attached to funding. But it's a good point, you know, that it doesn't, the ACA credits are not directly related to funding or not funding the government.
We're talking to Samantha Handler from Punchbowl News. She's coming to 14th and G direct from the belly of the United States Capitol. Samantha, I'm going to put you on the spot here because you're talking to everyone. Your colleagues are talking to everyone. Give us your best estimate, because no one knows. But if anyone knows, the reporters who are talking to everyone, the lobbyists who are talking to everyone, maybe the folks inside the Capitol know, or maybe they don't. But give us your best estimate. When are we going to see a resolution here? Are we going to see a resolution here? And what do you think breaks the logjam on both sides? Is it the healthcare issue, or is it something else?
I think it's air travel, and I think it's the pressure of the Thanksgiving holiday. I think we see this resolved probably November 21st, maybe November 22nd, bleeding into that weekend before Thanksgiving. You know, I'm not very optimistic that anything pushes or anything changes for lawmakers before then. I think we also have to get the House back, which is a challenge right now.
The Speaker has said that the House, having done its job and passing 30 days ago a clean extension to late November, has done its job, is not going to be in Washington until the Senate acts. That's what Samantha's referring to.
Exactly. So, you know, if the House isn't here, which, you know, they still are not, you know, you need something to call them back, and November 21st being the deadline for the CR that the House Republicans originally passed, you know, I think we won't really see anything until that week.
So you're right, you can't pass a continuing resolution that's already passed the House that has an expiration date of November 21st. On November 20th or November 21st, you're going to have to change the end date of that. And we'll get into this with Bill Hoagland in the second part of our segment today. There's a lot of different options. You could have another 30-day continuing resolution till Christmas time. Happy holidays. You could have a continuing resolution to early next year, at which point it becomes really difficult, or more difficult, I should say, to do something on the Affordable Care Act credits, because you're already into the new enrollment period and the new coverage period. But that's an option. You could have a longer-term continuing resolution to the next fiscal year. And I don't know if you sort of were bold, and I really respect that. You went right in there, Samantha, and said November 21st, and it's going to get solved by air traffic. Do you have another prediction as to how long the next continuing resolution or agreement's going to be? Is it short-term? Is it longer-term, or something else?
I think that's a harder question. I mean, we're hearing lawmakers, you know, senators start to talk about that now. I mean, I think a year-long CR, especially if we go into late November, is probably the most viable option, especially since there's not been much movement on full-year appropriations bills. You know, there's a minibus of three bills that's been hanging out there. But again, the House is not in session, so there hasn't been these bicameral, bipartisan talks that you need to make progress on full-year appropriations. So, I mean, maybe they could do one into January or February of next year if they think they can get something done. But, you know, we're already operating on a CR. So it's really – appropriators are motivated, and they want to get something done, but appropriators aren't really the problem, right? There's so many other people involved, and I just don't – I'm not very optimistic that full-year appropriations can get done quickly in December.
Right. Well, if your prediction is right, we'll have a sort of a nail-biting run-up to Thanksgiving with folks with a lot of flights worried that the air traffic controllers will show up for work or will show up and not be grumpy. And but that may
I
be.
I hope I'm wrong. I should say that. Yeah.
Well,
I
we all hope springs immediately. Right? Hope springs eternal. I want to before we leave the conversation, Samantha. I want to just ask you a little bit to shift the discussion. I want to ask you a little bit about Punch Bowl. When I came to Washington. Decades ago when I started work here at Mellman 20 years ago, and even in the last 5 to 10 years, there really wasn't anything like Punch Bowl. You know, you had some of your traditional media. People got it. People got their news from some of the traditional newspapers, the Washington Post or the New York Times. They read them online. They watched cable news. They looked at, you know, they listened to podcasts. They did other things. Punch Bowl is really – in some ways kind of fused reporting and access. Punch Bowl's been a little bit of a different animal, some of that really driven by the fact that we now have such you know, amazing new tools in terms of apps and you know, sort of real-time emails and things that can go out and postings. Talk to us for a minute here about sort of reporting at Punch Bowl and how you see – the organization that you work for, Punch Bowl News, which is relatively new in Washington, where does it fit in the reporting and information ecosystem in the nation's capital?
Punch Bowl News, I mean, we are reporters. We're here in the Capitol every day that the lawmakers are here, you know, roaming the halls. We're right there with them. You know, our goal is really just to report everything about the people, power, and politics going on in this building. You know, that drives, you know, conversations nationally, of course. We publish 3 newsletters a day so we can give real-time updates, break news immediately. We have text alerts. We have premium policy newsletters, you know, bringing you economic news, tax news, tech. I write a newsletter that goes out Monday mornings and Thursday afternoons just about the policy issues generally that you need to know about each week. And I think we've really, you know, capitalized on that newsletter format that, like you said, goes right into people's inboxes. It's convenient. You know, our text alerts when there's breaking news go right to your phones. You know, we are really pride ourselves on being where the people are who are influential and making these, you know, market moving decisions and giving that news immediately to our readers.
And how many reporters does Punch Bowl have right now? Roughly.
Oh, we just hired a new one. so I would have to check that for you. I think we're a little under 20, maybe 15 or 16. Don't quote me on that.
And you're all roaming the Capitol every day, all 15 or 16 of you.
Exactly. I'm not positive on the number.
And it's interesting. I know, you know, in some ways, again, being someone who is a, you know, a lobbyist or government affairs person, when I first started, a lot of times we'd have clients sort of, you know, call us and say, what's going on? And now they call us and say sometimes, what's really going on? But they often get their news first from someone like Punch Bowl or someone else. And that's changed. I'm sure you've seen that as well. It sort of paralleled your career as you've come here. I assume that you are a go-to source for a lot of folks who are just tracking the daily updates in Washington.
Absolutely. And that's what we try to do is, you know, say, like, this is what's going on now. You know, it may change later, but that's, you know, kind of why we also have an AM, a midday, and a PM update, right? Because things can change hour to hour here. And, you know, especially with the shutdown, things can move very quickly. So we want to make sure we keep people updated as soon as we know the news. And we've also really tried to make ourselves a one-stop shop for, you know, Hill staff, lobbyists, any, you know, people outside of Washington who want to know what's going on in Washington. So not only do we have newsletters, but we have, you know, legislative tracking tools, regulation tracking. We have a new AI system that helps you search congressional records and voting records. So we're, you know, really a one-stop shop for anything you need to know going on in Congress.
Is the new AI tool, is that what they call the portal, or is that something else?
Yes, it's part of the portal. It's the portal with NBlock AI.
And the portal allows you to do what as a reporter or as just a citizen?
The portal gives you access to congressional directories, certain, you know, so you can look up staffers, you can find bills, set alerts for legislation that you need to know about, you know, if, you know, it's getting a committee markup or maybe a vote. You could track the continuing resolution and, you know in real time when the 13th vote fails, as happened this week. So it really lets you more easily know what's going on in Capitol Hill.
Gotcha. Well, Punchbowl, obviously one of the important information resources dedicated, I think, sort of, you know, uniquely to kind of 100% what's going on in the Capitol in Washington, D.C. There's other great news sources out there, but it's that really interesting and important niche. And you're, as you point out, Samantha, bringing on more and more tools both to help your reporting and also to help others. Let me ask one other question. We talked earlier about the lack of trust between the Republicans and the Democrats. Clearly, when you look at polling, there's also a lack of trust in major institutions, including the media, including the press. At a time when everyone seems to distrust each other and so many Americans, so many policymakers distrust the media, how do you build trust in this polarized environment, both with your readers and also with your sources?
I mean, we just try to report on, you know, what's really going on, you know, giving each side the same treatment. You know, we treat each side the same, try to, you know, call out what's actually going on, get to the truth. And that goes a long way, right? You know, our sources know we are going to portray things accurately. We are going to, you know, give a fair frame to both sides. And that's really what we strive to do.
And is it hard to find people in Washington now with the shutdown to talk to you?
I mean, a lot of people are still here. Staff is still here working without getting paid. Which, you know, we feel for them, and it's a difficult situation. So we want to make sure we're telling them their stories, and they're all very invested on when the shutdown will end.
That's right. You've got the real live sources there. Well, Samantha Handler from Punchbowl News, thank you so much for being our guest today at 14th and G, for joining us at the intersection of politics and policy. I hope that you'll join us as a guest in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk. And yeah, hopefully next time we chat, there will not be a government shutdown.
I'm hoping right along with you. Thanks so much, Samantha.
Thank you.
Welcome to 14th and G. Thank you for tuning your podcast dial to us here at the intersection of politics and policy. We've got a very, very special guest with us today, Bill Hoagland. Many, many of you know Bill Hoagland. He has built a stellar career in Washington, D.C., worked as a senior staffer in the United States Senate for 3 decades, budget staff director, worked for several majority leaders, and is now senior vice president over at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Bill, there's not necessarily a ton of bipartisanship going on these days, so you'll have to tell us where the BPC or the Bipartisan Policy Center fits into that. But thank you so much for joining us here at 14th and G.
Thank you for having me, Dean. The Bipartisan Policy Center was established about 15 years ago by 4 former majority leaders. You worked with many of them, Dean, yourself, but on the Republican side was Senator Bob Dole and Senator Howard Baker, and on the Democratic side was Senator George Mitchell and Tom Daschle. And unfortunately, Senator Dole and Senator Baker have left us, and Senator Mitchell is in his late years, but Senator Daschle remains very active in our work.
Yeah, that's great.
And that's a different maybe a different type of Republican and Democrat than we have today. I don't want to go too far into that, but they were willing to work across the aisle, even though they were partisan individuals. And so trying to find that common ground on some of these major challenges remains our mission and goal.
And the Bipartisan Policy Center, I should say, is a little bit unique. You often find in Washington these think tanks that are aligned with not necessarily the parties, but sort of conservative thought or progressive thought. The Bipartisan Policy Center doesn't necessarily take it down the middle, but it tries to, as you said, find consensus.
That's our goal, and it's hard. It's hard in this environment, as you know.
Is it getting harder?
Yes, it's getting harder from my perspective.
Well, you're the guy to do it. Bill, I always start off and ask the guests, just walk us a little bit down memory lane. Tell me how you got to Washington initially as a young person and the jobs that you held early in your career and how that all led to this kind of storied career at the heart of the budget committees and the leadership in the Senate, and then to where you are now. And I want to say, just before we get going, that one of the reasons I wanted to sit down with Bill is we're now in the middle of going on our fourth week here in the government shutdown. I think we're approaching the longest one ever, but it's probably the second longest one. Is that right?
Well, it's the second longest one as it relates to every department being shut down. Yeah. We had the longest one back in the Trump first administration was, I think, about 36 days, but it was partial since Department of Defense, Department of Education, Department of Homeland Security were being funded. It was all the other agencies. So, but this is the longest one as it related, going on the longest one where all agencies have been shut down.
And that's why I wanted to have Bill in today, because it's really the budget and the appropriations process and the spending process. And we will talk about policy that's really at the heart of this. And there really is no person better in Washington to help us understand that. Bill, tell us a little bit, tell the listeners a little bit about your career. When you first came here as a young whippersnapper, what brought you to Washington? What did you do in those early years?
Well, thank you, Dean. I grew up in the state of Indiana on a farm, and I was focusing particularly on food issues and agriculture issues. And as a consequence, my graduate degree was on a program back in 1973-74 that was a relatively new program called the Food Stamp Program. And that thesis was I had developed a small little model that able to project the participation in that program. Now, looking back on it, it's not very sophisticated to the models that they have today. But anyway, that brought me to the Department of Agriculture, and I was at the Department of Agriculture just very briefly and received a phone call one day from a lady who I'd heard about and knew by reputation but didn't really know personally, and that was Alice Rivlin. And Alice called and said, we're setting up a new organization on Capitol Hill called the Congressional Budget Office, because we just passed the Congressional Budget Impoundment Control Act of 1974. And she said, I heard that you knew something about how to make these projections. Would you be one of the first bills up that we will have to analyze and estimate will be a farm bill? And at the end of the farm bill is the, at that time, was called the food stamp title. And we, so I took a risk. I made a decision, a serendipity. I ended up at CBO, and CBO was really the start where I began most of my real work in budget. And brief turn later on with the Department of Agriculture back at the agency as the administrator of the programs, not just the food stamps, but the child nutrition, the other federal feeding programs.
And this is in the Reagan administration.
This is in the Reagan administration. And since you raised it a little bit, I'm a little nervous to go there, but I can look back on it.
Yeah, tell us, Bill, the intersection of history in the Reagan administration department.
I got in trouble with implementing some regulations that later became known as ketchup is a vegetable. And as a consequence, Senator Dole, who I'd got to know, took pity with me, I guess, and brought me back to the Hill. And so in 1981 or 82, early 82, went back to the Hill. And there I spent the next 28 years on Capitol Hill, and had the pleasure working with you, yeah, Dean, later on with in Majority Leader Bill Frist's office.
That was a great pleasure. But tell us, at the heart of the catch-up thing was we were trying to save federal dollars and try to figure out on the child's lunch food how you could get the most vegetables in for the dollar, or what was the purpose?
Well, the issue of that was that we go back is that literally the last one of the bosses that I worked with was Senator Pete Domenici. And later on, he always said that he invented the reconciliation process. Well, no, that's not true. The first reconciliation bill was done in 1980 when Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate. And I was at CBO, and Democratic-controlled Congress said, we got to do something to show this upstart governor out there in California who wants to become president that we really have control over fiscal issues here. And so the Democrats put together a package that had a small 2-cent reduction in the non-needy school lunch program. I made that estimate at CBO. Well, lo and behold, now it becomes law. I go to USDA, and now I have to implement the law. And in implementing the law, what we said was, I talked to a number of people who are administering the program, said, well, don't cut us. I said, I don't have any choice. I have to reduce it. That's the law, 2.5 cents off the non-needy school. He said, well, if you're going to do that, give us some flexibility on the regulation. There are regulations require a certain amount of protein and calcium, other things in the school lunch program. And so I suggested that some place said, we like tofu. I said, I'm not a tofu fan, but if you want to substitute that for protein, go right ahead. Well, who do you make mad with doing that? You tick off the meat producers because tofu is a substitute for a red meat, if you like. And dairy, somebody said, well, let's do yogurt anyway, as opposed to the high-fat milk content. I said, fine, we'll do that. But in issuing those regulations, somehow something got slipped in it that suggested that condiments could be considered a vegetable. And it's not true, but it was just enough to make the two very powerful lobbyists in this town, the American Meat Association, American Dairy Association, something that allowed them to play that up, and that's caused trouble. Didn't help matters, I guess, that Mrs. Reagan had purchased a bunch of very expensive china that August. And that was the other lesson I learned early on. If you're going to be an administrator in this town, be careful about issuing regulations in the month of August when nothing else is going on and they're out of town.
People because are paying attention.
People can dig into them at that stage. Yeah. But that's the story behind
the
it.
The story of Ketchup Gate. You survived Ketchup Gate, went on to a storied career. And with that background, Bill, starting off as the budget committee, starting off in nutrition policy, we're talking about some of the things that might lead to a reopening, and I want to circle back to that around the SNAP program,
right.
Some of the nutrition programs. But I want to just first set the historical context for where we are. This is not the first shutdown we've had. I read the other day that we are increasingly sort of funding the government in the last decade or so by continuing resolution or partial resolution, not going through the regular process. I mean, you really started, or the kind of the heart of your career on Capitol Hill was around budgeting, around the process of we've got a dozen annual spending or appropriations bills. Did it work better at the beginning? Is it breaking down now? Why is that, and what's sort of leading to the where we are now with sort of the shutdown?
Yeah, I think early on when the Congressional Budget Empowerment Control Act was put together, it certainly established a process by which Congress was to set a blueprint for its amount of spending, amount of revenues taken in. And part of that adoption of a budget blueprint to guide appropriations was to set a total amount of spending for the various what we call the discretionary programs, about one-third of the federal spending. And early on, up until I would argue up until about 2000, over the 50-year history of the Budget Act, we've had about 14 times that we haven't put together a budget blueprint at the beginning of the process. And by the way, 13 of those have been here in the last 15 years.
Wow. So it's increasing.
It's increasing. And because of that, when you don't have a blueprint, it makes it much more difficult to put together the appropriation bills. The last time we've had all 12, I guess we used when we first started, Dean, on the Hill, there were 13 subcommittees. Now there's 12. When we
made it easier, and it's still getting harder.
And we ended up the last time passing all of them was in 1997. And interestingly enough, when I look back on it, it was that came out of another crisis in 1995, 1996. People talk about shutdowns. You and I will remember that was a very difficult shutdown over the holiday. And not, by the way, not just one shutdown, but two shutdowns. And out of that crisis then became, after the Clinton won his second term, we went to work and said, let's bury the hatchet, let's work together. And we passed the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. That allowed us to pass the appropriation. But ever since, it's been very difficult. And let me just say, just because you have a budget resolution doesn't mean that you're going to get all your 12 appropriation bills done. I think in our career, Dean, up there, many times the issues were not just the money, but what we call the riders that had to do with particularly the sensitive ones, whether it's abortion or other things like that, or earmarks. And that's become – but right now it seems like the norm that that applied over those issues, the norms, the behaviors, they've changed dramatically as the country – as the politics have driven us further apart. And that made it more difficult to come to an agreement, first of all, on a budget resolution, let alone the appropriations going forward.
So you just really outlined a process where for really 30 years we've not had kind of regular order on the appropriations bills, the budget blueprint for three decades. What's at the heart of this one or this last few bill? Is it the lack of a budget blueprint? Is it disagreements over spending levels? Is it policy disagreements? Is it the so-called riders, policy riders? Is it the what is causing the increasing frequency of what seems like kind of a breakdown to most average Americans?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I don't think it's dollars so much in terms of discretionary, the appropriated accounts. I think it's clear that everybody can see where the Democrats have asked for an extension of some expiring premium tax credits later this year. And on that score, I do believe that that is the major hang up right now, getting an agreement for an extension or some sort of a modification to those expiring tax premium tax credits. As we all know from and we will hear more later this week as plans issue their premiums, some major increases here. I would also note it's kind of interesting, as we were discussing a little bit ahead of time, that even in the 1995-96 shutdown, the major issue that was dividing us back then was also the Medicare Part B premium. Mm-hmm. And then the shutdown, the big shutdown in the first Trump administration, 2017-2018, was over the Affordable Care Act. And now here this one's over the premium tax credit. Healthcare policy continues to be one of the major factors that causes has been causing these shutdowns going forward.
Yeah, so it's increasingly not so much trying to set the overall number or the agreement. It's the policy. And in this case, we had a podcast earlier with Larry Lebbit from KFF.
Oh, sure.
And my colleagues, Ali Mlinar, Republican, and Lauren Aronson, a Democrat. We really kind of dove deeply into the issue of the premium tax credits from a substantive standpoint. In this case, it's sort of interesting because the Republicans run everything, the House, the Senate, the administration – the Trump administration. And my sense was the Democrats are sort of using this as really the one or one of the few leverage points they have to say either this policy is important or we think the politics of this is pretty good. And that seems like it's been the case a couple of times in the past with healthcare, as you point out.
And I do think that that is a major issue. But there's something also that's going on right now with this shutdown, and that has to do with trust. There is a sense that between the and I blame both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, to be honest with you, because when Congress doesn't do its job and doesn't pass appropriation bills on time, doesn't do a budget, doesn't get their work done on time, that creates a vacuum that allows for the an administration, an executive that believes in unitary executive control to fill that gap. And yet some of the things that the current administration have done has created a friction with the appropriators, such as impounding monies and the pocket rescission that recently occurred. And so there is a degree of mistrust, even if we reach an agreement, Democrats with Republicans? Will it be enforced? Will it be carried out? And I think that adds to this difficulty of finding an agreement here on moving forward.
Let me ask you a follow-up on that, Bill, because it's interesting to me. When we were sort of heading into the shutdown, there was a lot of frustration on Capitol Hill among Democrats, clearly with some of the policies of this administration on things like pocket rescissions and other things, a lot of challenges to the legality of that, a feeling that the Trump administration was overstepping their bounds on some of these spending issues. In some ways, if you think about what happened over the first 6 months, you would have thought that the hill that the Democrats wanted to die on here was going to be, you know, we're not going to appropriate this money in a bipartisan way if you are going to unilaterally decide how to spend it. But this shutdown for the Democrats became really about healthcare policy. Why do you think that is?
Because I think it is the only lever they have to try to work some sort of agreement out. I also think it's playing to their base. I think there are a lot of people. And by the way, there are, from my perspective, there are a number of Republican members who are concerned about rising premiums for middle class. And some of these are red states. So I think this is an opportunity. Again, I think both House and Senate and Republicans and Democrats can take some of the blame here. I don't think anybody is necessarily winning except the American public are losing in this fight. But this is right now, compared to the career that you and I had on the Hill, this is very much different. There is a real mistrust. There's real division. And that's sad as we move into our 250th anniversary of this country next year. Wasn't it Madison? It used to say that in a country as big and diverse as the United States, you have to have compromise. And that word compromise seems to be not in the lexicon of most members these days.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, Bill, you talk about trust and some of these factors of getting people to the table. I've sort of said over the last couple of weeks, it feels to me like neither side is really winning, but neither side believes that it's losing either.
Yeah, that's true.
And you've got some of the pain points so far that have traditionally played in here that have been taken off the table. And I think that to me are two factors. One, and I bring back to the bipartisan policy center, the parties right now don't seem to be playing to middle America or the middle of the country. They're sort of getting the Democrats kind of propped up by their base, as you said earlier. The Republicans are really comfortable, it seems to me, with where they are, which is we're not going to negotiate over a permanent policy here on a 7-week or now what's a 3 or 4 week continuing resolution. So both sides seem really dug in. And the question is what – facts are going to possibly change it. You mentioned your background with nutrition policy. We've got some huge issues that are starting to come up where the administration says it can no longer fund some of the nutrition programs. You've got military pay. You've got the TSA. I flew the other day and I thank the TSA workers who are working without a paycheck as we get closer to the holiday season. That's going to be more difficult. But do you see some of those external factors sort of changing things here, or is it just going to come down to a fight over healthcare?
No, I do. I think you're absolutely correct. I too flew last week and thanked the TSA worker, but also my flight was majorly delayed too, and I don't know if it was all because of the shutdown or not. But I do think you've nailed what the major factors are, Dean, that are going to really be external factors, beginning with number one, later this week, 5 days from today, the SNAP program, it funds something like 42 million Americans, 22 million households, half of them being children.
This is called supplemental nutrition.
Supplemental nutrition, the old food stamp program. Mm-hmm. To that extent that those programs, the running out of those programs beginning here in November in 5 days, that will put a lot of pressure on. Second of all, the military pay, the administration was able to move some money around. There might be some question as to whether it was legal what they did, but who's gonna object? Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican to paying our, I think we should pay our military, but there's only so much of that. There was only so much that they could transfer. also in the WIC program, another program I'm familiar with, Women, Infants, and Children. That program could only maybe in a couple weeks. It's going to be out of money too. And there was a effort made, and there was a procedure made to use some of what we call the tariff receipts that come in under current law that the Department of Agriculture is able to. It's called Section 32 of an old Agriculture Act way back in 1933 that gives mandatory funding to Department of Agriculture. They were able to use some of that money, but that's limited. And as it relates to back to the food stamp or the SNAP program, there are those who argue that the administration has a discretionary fund. It's interesting from my perspective. It's about $8 billion. Again, it comes from some of these mandatory funds from our tariff receipts that we get. But it's interesting. We spend about $8 billion a month on our SNAP program. So the question for the Department of Agriculture is whether they use that for SNAP or do they use that to bail out farmers. So, and then to your big point, the first payday was missed for most. It's this next payday that's really going to start to crimp, and particularly for those TSA workers and those air traffic control workers, we start to see a slowdown. It's those external factors, I think, that will really move us toward coming to some settlement here, one way or the other.
I'm gonna put you on the spot, Bill, and of course, none of us know, and I've been wrong more times than I can count, but. Given all that and given your history and given some of the timing of these external factors, as you talked about, when do you think this thing ends? And also right now, the mechanics of it, the continuing resolution that the House voted on several weeks ago only would fund the government if it passed today for another few weeks through
November 17th.
So how and when do we get out of this thing, and what has to happen with the continuing resolution to do it? Because they can't probably just punt it for another week or two.
Correct. Well, I'm out on a limb, as you say.
Okay. Well, I'll climb out there with you.
I'm gonna suggest that we probably will see some sort of a resolution here right around the 1st of November, maybe right after Halloween, if you like. And I think that more thoughtful minds will come together and say, listen, we got to bring this to an end. This is starting to really hurt people. And I do believe that that's a good possibility that we'll have some sort of an agreement. But to your point, even if they were to pass what the House passed clean, it would only take us to November the 17th. And that brings me to what then on being the gloom and doomer that a budgeteer usually is. It reminds me a lot of what happened in 1995 and 1996. We had not one shutdown in that very difficult period. We had two shutdowns. It is possible we could end up here opening the government up, but we could then again see another shutdown coming later this winter around the holiday season. So I'll simply say that I think that we're going to get out of this one sometime early November, whether and how we go forward. Now, there are some people that have suggested that when we open it back up that we have a full year CR. We just clean the slate throughout, and we just fund government for the rest of the year.
Can that be through the fiscal year of next year?
Through the fiscal year. Yeah. The difficulty with that from an old budgeteer and perspective is then you have given the President of the United States an awful lot of authority, flexibility. Most of the appropriation bills, when they are passed, have conference reports, and those conference reports lay out certain procedures. If you don't have a conference report on individual appropriation bills, this gives the administration an awful lot of – and this is the thing that worries, I think, Democrats. So, yes, there is a possibility of a continuing resolution for the rest of the year at last year's level. At the same time, that would not fund defense at the level that most people would like. And as a consequence, I'm not sure about a continuing resolution for the rest of the year. But that is one of the possibilities that's on the table.
Yeah. So and do you have a view, and you may not, of do you think it's more likely that we end up with a longer-term continuing resolution or a short-term with some negotiation?
I think every effort's going to be made by particularly the appropriation chairs, Susan Collins and Tom Cole, to get as many of the appropriations. But quite frankly, the House has reported out all its appropriation bills. The Senate has done most of its appropriation bills, and they have a package ready to go. They're going to want to do appropriation bills, the old, even if they are late. So I think we're probably looking at some sort of another short-term continuing resolution and further negotiations around that. But again, it comes back not so much to the dollars as to what are they going to do with these premium tax credits that expire at the end of December.
Yeah, and the timing issue on the tax credits is really complicated too, because the practical timeline for the tax credits where people – now they're in the so-called window shopping period, as you know. November 1, the exchanges, the ACA Obamacare exchanges go live, and people get to actually see what's been estimated all along, which is these premium increases likely to go up. And then, but people have to choose and enroll by January, and the later you get in the year, and the more that at least Republicans who are willing to talk about this are also talking about the need for reform,
yeah,
the mm-hmm. more difficult it gets to do that.
I think there will have to be in any final agreement on the premium tax credits. I think they will be extended, whether it's 1 year or 2 years. Probably the best would be if they extend it for 2 years so they get it beyond the next midterm election. But I don't think they're going to be able to pass those extensions without some form of changes. And particularly, I think people are looking at issues associated with the eligibility level. I think right now you can go up above 400% of poverty. Yeah. I think that's that for a family of four, that's about $128,000. I think that's I think there are some things that can be done at least at that higher end. At the higher income, so there will be some reforms if it's even going to pass the House later on this year.
And right now, the House Republicans are saying that they're willing to talk about it, but beyond some of those reforms to the credit, they're talking about other reforms like association health plans and other things, which could raise also other partisan complications. So I'm getting less optimistic that healthcare is going to be the way out of this. But as you said, that's been where we have shut down.
And to your point, we could open it up and we could start these negotiations, and we can't finalize these negotiations because of all the issues that you put on the table already here. That's why I say we could have a second touch shutdown this winter.
Yeah, well, and the Bill, you are not giving me a lot of hope and optimism about any of the scenarios. Let me ask you, maybe in just the few minutes we have remaining, to sort of maybe kind of conclude where we started, which is you've been in Washington for a long time. You've seen the budget and appropriations process from all kinds of different angles, from a very senior perch in the United States Senate, right at the Budget Committee, to an administration perch, to an agency, the early days of the Congressional Budget Office, to now at the Bipartisan Policy Center. And I think one of the unique things, not only about BPC, but about other sort of think tanks, is you get an opportunity to sort of get out of the passion of government. You get an opportunity to sort of look around the corner a little bit and say, not only how do we deal with the current situation, but what should we be doing? And I want to ask, I mean, again, the statistic that you put out earlier, it's been since the mid-90s when we've actually passed all these appropriations bills. We've had an increasing number of continuing resolutions. We've had an increasing number of shutdowns. They've been a mix of spending and policy driven. What should we be thinking about? I mean, this doesn't seem like any way to run a railroad, as they used to say it. What are two or three things that either the Bipartisan Policy Center is working on or that you believe we ought to think about to get structurally a more better functioning spending and appropriations process? Or is it just inevitable in the divided government we have and the close margins and the change elections that we've seen that this is just going to be a fact of life here in Washington?
I hope it's not a fact of life. I think we have to get back to some form of a regular order for the good of the American public going forward and to restore trust in their government. I have my favorite approaches. First of all, would be I'd like to see us move back toward a maybe have a biennial budget as opposed to an annual budget. We have to go through this every year. I think that there are things that we need to reform the budget process rather maturely. I would change the structure of the budget committees going forward to make them more leadership oriented. I also would, we even talked about it here, but just make a, when you pass a budget resolution, you've voted on the statutory debt limit. Go ahead. You've done it once. Go ahead and just simply send it to the president. So once upon the adoption of a budget resolution, you've adopted a debt limit. So we're not faced with that cliff also coming under. But more importantly, I think it's just restoring trust across the board is going to be critical. And how you do that, that means members. That means people working at the grassroots level, understanding government and understanding what, as I say, as we go into our, you know, there's a slight little hope I have here that as we go into our 250th anniversary of this country, people are going to remember why we have the system we have of checks and balances between the executive and the legislative. I think we're going to start, hopefully we refresh our civic understanding of why we have the republic that we have, and hopefully that we can retain it going forward.
And Bill, that's a perfect place to end. I was going to ask you what your hope is for the future, to leave us with some hopeful words as we get close to the holidays.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being our guest here at 14th and G. Great, great conversation. Really enjoyed it. Always enjoy seeing you. And thanks for your leadership and what you're doing. And, you know, hope springs eternal that we'll get out of this and get to better days. Thank you so much, Bill Hoagland, for being a guest at 14th and G.
Thank you, Dean.